Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past, in partnership with BNP Paribas. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you, Brian?
I'm so amazed at all the laundered euros that are pouring into our podcast bank account thanks to these new sponsorships we're getting. And how are you, Sean?
Oh, super, as always.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you detect a bit of a foggy haze about us, it's been a bank holiday weekend here in London, and we were out on the tiles. We might be a little bit worse for wear.
Yeah, we had the champagne giggles last night.
It somehow feels appropriate for the book and film that we're about to be covering in the world of the Bohemian demi-monde.
Although something tells me even the most banal conversations we had last night were not half as vacuous as some of the stories in the book we're about to talk about today.
So do you prefer a demi-monde or a demi-more?
Monde.
How about a demi-tasse?
Yes.
Now, Sean, I suspect that most of our listeners are scratching their heads and pulling their hair and tapping their feet.
Funny, because I'm scratching my balls right now.
Saying to themselves, what is a Tama? What is a Janowitz? Why have Brian and Sean decided to do something about slavery? What is this book in this film? And yet, for years, basically since when we first met each other, we have been desperate, dying to familiarize ourselves with Slaves of New York.
Yes, well, a Tama, first of all, is a type of tampon you can use in space. and yes, we have been both fascinated by Slaves of New York almost from the moment we met. You are indeed correct.
Now, Tama is also a woman's name, an author, Tama Janowitz,
yeah,
who wrote the volume that we have now read. But you first heard of her in a very unusual context.
Anyone who knows me will know that I am a huge fan of Sandra Bernhardt from about 1981 to 1991. And within that time, Sandra Bernhardt was on David Letterman about 20-something times. And about 10 of these times are all on YouTube. And they are some of the best interview television you could possibly watch. You will find yourself going down a wormhole with these clips.
Your brain will fall out of your head and you'll need a Diane von Furstenberg paper towel to clean it up. Am I right?
Oh, you're right, babe. And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, we know you're never going to read Slaves of New York or see the film, but do spend some time watching those Sandra Bernhardt clips on YouTube. So within one episode, Sandra comes out, and Sandra is a little bit ticked off, shall we say, that David Letterman spent an entire episode flirting with this Tama Janowitz with a fuck to do.
Mm-hmm. I came out here and I laid myself on the line for you, mm-hmm. and I always do. I'm wide open, and mm-hmm. you never give me anything. If I kiss you, you're a dog. Mm-hmm. If I say something complimentary, you're a fool.
Yeah.
And then Tama Janowitz comes out here with the fuck to do. Do and don't, and you're all over her like cheap perfume, and then you took her gum.
And I was like, who is this Tama Janowitz person? So I then fell down the wormhole and found these interviews with this woman called Tama Janowitz, and she has that kind of like season 2, season 3 RuPaul's Drag Race hair, you know, dried up ass old wig, ratty, you know, different color of blonde.
She was on Letterman a few times.
Yeah,
right?
She was. I gotta say though, her interview chat did not inspire me and did not give me chills, as it were, shivers, to read Slaves of New York. Like, are you some big New York personality?
In your wormhole research, did you get any sense of why Tama Janowitz was a big deal?
She and her writing was very au courant.
When?
In the 1980s.
Yeah.
And I think when she was going on Letterman and when she was publishing the books, like Slaves of New York, for example, there was a great sense of immediacy about the zeitgeist. You know, New York of the 1980s, very much the Gordon Gekko greed is good.
Donald Trump era,
you know?
I'm sure Tama hobnobbed with Donald back in his
Ivana days,
right?
Excuse me.
Right?
Now we're in the Ivanka days.
They were probably all going to the same nightclubs and
snorting cocaine off the same gilded plate. Am I allowed to say that? Oh, who cares? No one's listening.
I think there was some sort of market in the 80s for, like, hot novelists who were writing about urban excess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was, like, the thing to write about. And they were also living, I presume, this life that kind of mirrored the things they were writing about.
But that's not how you heard about Tama Janowitz,
is not indeed. Well, I'm not sure that I knew that much about Tama herself, but definitely when you and I were watching those Sandra clips and you were like, yeah, she wrote this thing called Slaves of New York. What is that? So I was like, Slaves of New York? Well, of course I've heard of it. It's a movie with Bernadette Peters. The reason I knew about it was, now, dedicated listeners surely know that to the degree to which Sean is dedicated to Sandra Bernhard, I am dedicated to Merchant Ivory. No, that's not true, actually. Sean loves all Sandra Bernhard.
No, I don't. I love Sandra Bernhard 1981 to 1991.
Okay, then in that sense, maybe it is a correct analogy, because I love Merchant Ivory from about 1988 to 1994. I mean, I'm not... Don't give me...
Le divorce, Brian, please.
Okay, so Merchant Ivory, who are they? What have they done? Well, yes, so...
What do they want from me?
Yeah, you know, Merchant Ivory, as many people know, are probably synonymous with literary adaptation. Some people would say period films. Their raison d'être was to adapt great works of literature. And their high watermarks are, you know, all of them basically Oscar nominated. We're talking about Room with a View, The Bostonians, Howard's End, of course, with Emma Thompson, The Remains of the Day. These are incredible. Even things like Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, that got Joanne Woodward an Oscar nomination. Morris, the E.M. Forster gay novel they did.
Was that a success?
It's definitely in the kind of queer canon. It's a pretty good adaptation. It's quite sexy as well. That's for another day. But so...
Oh, no, it's not.
So, Merchant Ivory, I fell in love with them in the height of my Emma Thompson infatuation. I watched a lot of those adaptations. Similar to Sandra and Tama, I think Merchant Ivory reached their sell-by date somewhere around the time that they did Jefferson in Paris, and then surviving Picasso with Anthony Hopkins as Picasso, and then reaching a kind of plummet point with the aforementioned Le Divorce,
yeah,
and also the Golden Bowl.
Of course, the bowl. Cracked, but not broken.
But
so, Brian, do you think that maybe the name Merchant Ivory began as kind of a name of quality, then kind of transformed itself into a name synonymous with a very particular kind of stuffiness and high art mindedness.
I mean, you've often talked about how the name melodrama, the term melodrama, is used disparagingly. I think a lot of people say Merchant Ivory to mean bad costume drama. And anyone who's seen Howard's End, who's seen The Remains of the Day, they know that actually Merchant Ivory breathed life into these things and captured the kind of beating heart and the marrow of some of these books in a way that, like, I think something like David Lean's version of A Passage to India is, like, dead on arrival, whereas their E.M. Forster adaptations are amazing. But where I came across Slaves of New York was when I was a kid, we've never said this on the podcast, I don't think, but I read...
You've just said this to your therapist.
I read those thick Roger Ebert home video companions. I had about four of them, and I read them cover to cover, by which I mean in alphabetical order. I read the capsule. They weren't capsule
Babe,
reviews.
I can totally empathize. I had the equivalent, which was the Halliwell's Guide.
I had Halliwell as well. I never read Halliwell cover to cover. The Ebert ones are his newspaper reviews in alphabetical order, and each time he brought out a new one, some of the older reviews would stay in, new reviews would come, and he'd kind of pick and choose and curate them. And I read them all. I would sometimes skip the ones I'd read before, but sometimes I'd reread them. And I can, like, remember exactly, like, which ones got 3 stars versus 3.5 versus 4, you know, which ones Ebert said were the best movies. And there was one that always stood out for me. It was Slaves of New York. I believe it got perhaps 1 or possibly even no stars.
Oh, wow.
And I remember thinking, wait, this is a movie set in 1980s New York, but it's a Merchant Ivory movie? What the hell is this? Ebert hated this film. I mean, we should look up exactly what he said. It's something like, none of the behavior of any of the characters in this film replicates the human condition, or something like that. I always filed it away as this weird oddity, and I think, other than Le Divorce, which I have also seen that movie twice, in the theater, it has Naomi Watts in it, and Sam Waterston and Stalker Channing.
Why did you see it twice?
I saw it once when it came out in theaters. I was in high school.
Were you with someone?
Yes, a friend. A high school friend who turned out to be gay as well.
Who?
Those who went to see Le Divorce, it remains hidden behind the veil of history.
Everyone who saw Le Divorce signed a non-disclosure agreement.
Kate Hudson doesn't even like to acknowledge that she's seen it.
Goldie and her actually stopped talking for quite a while after she made that.
Do you know that Le Divorce ends with a high-stakes terrorist shootout on the top of the Eiffel Tower? That's not a joke.
Okay.
It literally does. But then it's all played for laughs. So, of course, when Sean brings up his Tama experience, it became inevitable that someday we would do Slaves of New York. And that day has arrived.
Yes.
However, in order to get to the money shot of actually watching the film, we had to do a bit of work beforehand. And that work was to actually read the book, Slaves of New York, written by Tama Janowitz.
Now, anyone who knows Brian will know that Brian has never been given homework that he has not done to completion and then some. Now, me, on the other hand, I have read all that is humanly possible of this book. So, I don't think I'm missing out on anything by not knowing it entirely.
So, I'm reading along. I'm, like, on to, like, page 150 or something. And I'm like, when are these characters ever gonna, like, get going with something? Like, there's no narrative to this. And then
he was freaking out.
I remember from across the room saying to Sean, like, I mean, it's just not going anywhere. I don't understand. And then I looked on Wikipedia and it said, Tama Janowitz's acclaimed volume of short stories. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to pause for a moment and realize I am a seasoned reader, okay? There is something about this book that I could not tell whether it was meant to be a novel or a volume of short stories. Think about the degree of aimlessness and shapelessness that must be implied by that, because there are recurring characters. There's a young woman named Eleanor who is in the book, a frustrated jewelry maker.
And she has a few episodes, isn't she?
She has quite a few, yeah. She's with this kind of egocentric, chauvinist, asshole
called
boyfriend.
Stash.
Anyway, so she and Stash go to various openings and parties and this and that. So you can see why I thought, oh, there's going to be some sort of plot that's going to link all this. No, these are just self-contained little episodes. Mm-hmm. There's another character who recurs, a kind of over-the-top artist named Marley Martello, mm-hmm. I think his name
That's it,
is.
Yeah.
He's kind of always struggling. He dreams of making frescoes that are like pastiches
of
Renaissance art.
Yeah, he's like a professional douchebag.
Yeah, he's terrible. Yeah. And he has a ridiculous dealer named Ginger. Perhaps attentive listeners have realized from the tone of our voice that we are not urging you to go out and read Tama Janowitz.
Well, the way I see it, it's like, you know when you meet someone at a party and they're really self-important and they tell you a whole lot of stories and name drop all these people you're never going to meet and don't care about? This is what that book is. It is kind of about nothing.
Tama Janowitz, her narrative style is very much in keeping with the so-called heroine of the books, Eleanor. She's very withdrawn. She seems quite passive all the time. I wouldn't call it self-important so much as just like dizzy, ditzy, and kind of all over the map without a coherent point.
It's like that conversation with that person at the party. It's like, why? What's the point of all this?
Where are these anecdotes going? And actually, there are times where our character Eleanor is at a party telling anecdotes and realizing that no one's listening to her and the anecdotes are going nowhere. So it's some quite meta thing. From the bits that you read, like, what are typical Slaves of New York type situations that you came across?
Okay, so talking about how expensive it is to live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Food.
Oh my god, food is mentioned so often. Everything from, you know, canapés to
duck confit,
grilled cheese. There's a
fondue.
There's a whole short story that's just called Fondue and is about a conversation between the heroine and her mother about eating fondue. I quite like fondue. Not the story, the actual thing. I love fondue. Envisioning melted cheese made me happy. I don't know, if we've never had fondue, have we?
No, we haven't. It is one of the more interesting things to come out of Switzerland, though.
Oh, come on. I mean, does it compare to the cuckoo clock?
Not yet to the cuckoo clock, although I am a huge fan of euthanasia.
This is like Family Feud, so it's like, survey says, euthanasia, number one, fondue, number two.
But is that really it? Like, you're dipping bread into melted cheese? Any child can think
it's
of that.
It's participatory.
How can a whole nation come up with that genius
idea? It's the dining equivalent of participatory theater. Anyway, food figures prominently, art openings, and basically, I would say another prominent feature
is... Neuroses?
Yeah, definitely neuroses. But it's also, like, people being in relationships that they know are bad, but they stay in them for reasons that they're sort of not acknowledging.
Doesn't it make you despair about heterosexual culture?
As we're describing this, we could probably say a lot of those same things about, like, I don't know, the films of Woody Allen, you know, lots of other sort of urban comedies. But there's just something about her...
There's a flatness to it.
The acuteness of her eye, I don't think is particularly strong. There are, you know, memorable passages, like notably the one about the title itself. Maybe we should read that bit.
My friend Abby called me up from Boston. She was all hysterical. It's like this. She's been living with this guy for a few years. He was an art director for an advertising agency, and she has a good job teaching at Simmons, tenure. But it's Roger's house, an old Back Bay brownstone that he's fixed up. And now he's lost his job and he wants her to start making some financial contribution, but he still doesn't want to marry her. Just at this time, Abby's old flame reappears. He wants her to move to New York and live with him. What are you going to do? I said. Abby said that even though this old flame, Bruce, was a jerk, she was bored with Boston and Roger. I could live in New York with Bruce, she said, and fly up to Boston to teach one day a week, and maybe I'll meet someone I like better than Bruce in New York. I said, Abby, don't do it. In the old days, marriages were arranged by the parents, and maybe you ended up with a jerk, but at least you had the security of marriage. No one could dump you out in the street. In today's world, it's the slave system. If you live with this guy in New York, you'll be the slave. Well, she said, I'm used to Roger cooking for us. What would I have to do for Bruce? She already knew all about my dinner menus, the frantic daily preparations. Yes, I said, you'd have to cook for Bruce. What are you going to do if you have a fight and he tells you to leave? With your salary, you'll never be able to find an apartment. I know Bruce is a creep, she said, but I thought I'd be with him while I looked for someone else. And it goes on.
I think literally that passage is just about everything we described. It has real estate and the kind of slave mentality that it requires.
Neuroses,
food, right? Food and people staying in, like, completely terrible relationships.
And that's the quality of conversation. That's probably in the higher end of qualities.
It also has something that you identified, Sean, which is, like, just a string of names of characters that, like, picture Brian reading this and being like, oh, are these people going
to
become important?
Oh,
Abby and Bruce and Roger.
Friends.
And they just don't appear again. Can I just ask you, do you like this kind of satire in any form? By which I mean kind of like social satire that's skewering an era, an age, a kind of type of person.
Well, the thing is, like you mentioned Woody Allen a little while ago. I am not a New Yorker. I haven't lived in New York. But at the same time, I can still go and see one of his films and enjoy it and be like, oh, I'm so witty. I'm part of this world.
It's not 10,000 miles away from this. So what is it that great satire has that this does not?
It's not as bleak. You think about the Woody Allen characters themselves are always neurotic, they're always pathetic, but they're very often likable, funny, acerbic, incisive, and cheery.
Someone must have said at some point somewhere that nothing ages faster than cottage cheese. No, than really up-to-the-minute social satire, right? And like, to use like my frame of reference, when I was doing my master's degree in Renaissance drama, I mean, I read quite a lot of Jacobean comedies. They're essentially the same as this, right? Except the things that they're parodying are all like the up-to-the-minute trends of the 16th century. I mean, we just went to see Twelfth Night at the NT, and like Malvolio is like a type, right? He's like a Puritan. And I'm sure that all that stuff where he wears the cross garters and the yellow stockings is like the way that we would make fun today of hipsters wearing
no socks,
tight jeans, and their shirts buttoned in a particular way. You know, something that Shakespeare and Woody Allen are able to do is like have all those trappings of contemporary trends, whether you're satirizing Puritans or stockbrokers or
Upper East Siders.
Tama Janowitz, the characters have no heart. The satire just feels like little sketches that are interesting for about a month. Like, they keep talking about sushi. You know, sushi is like this such an exciting thing because it's the first time it's come to New York. And it's like, okay, making fun of sushi, honestly, is like the most out-of-date thing I could possibly think of. In great satire like that, there are more layers that you can get to, or there's a story, or there's a kind of universal something, which you would think this might have because it's about love and choices, but it's not really.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm just thinking about those Sandra Bernhardt interviews on Letterman. You know, she is name-dropping celebrities of the moment all the time, but she's doing them in such a kind of a wry, disparaging fashion. Yeah. It's like talking about Lee Iacocca running you over, running her over in his car, and like Telly Savalas as president.
Part of the joy of the fact that I'm 10 years older than you is like, Sean was like, now who is Lee Iacocca? And at least I knew that he was the president of a car manufacturer. And he sold olive oil spread on television.
It's like Sandra presents that in such a kind of a humorous, kind of like winking, tongue-in-cheek way. Whereas this just feels so much more serious.
Well, in a way, what...
Like, satire can be serious, but it's also supposed to be funny. And this is not funny.
Well, what Sandra's doing, I think, is so meta because she's almost embodying a manic version of that kind of person, but with a complete deadpan.
Yeah, an anarchic deadpan, whereas this feels so uptight.
Yeah.
Do you not find that the writing is uptight?
Frankly, it's just not funny. I mean, there's pages and pages of things that you can see are meant to be jokes. I mean, I have to say, I was appalled to see where some of these short stories were published. And, you know, some of them in places that I would expect, like Interview magazine, not to disparage it, but it just seems to me like that's a very scene, like...
Zeitgeist.
Celebrity-driven thing. But, like, no fewer than, like, 6 of them, I think, were published in The New Yorker.
That's bad.
Yeah.
That's bad. That's really bad.
Listener Michael Schulman, can you get into The New Yorker archives and, like, you know, redact that or something? Like, we'd have to have a Stalinist purge. So
David Remnick would love that.
Lenin's tomb. So, anyway, somewhere along the way, this book, it was popular. It was optioned into a movie. Does it make sense at all that Merchant Ivory are the people who've come to do this? So this is director James Ivory, who I never knew was gay until, like, this year. I really didn't. He's apparently, like, openly gay. It's amazing.
Oh, my God.
Incredible. So it's Merchant and his... And Ivory...
It's Merchant and his Ivory.
Well, no, they were lovers. I didn't know this.
Get out of town.
Yeah, Merchant was the producer and Ivory was the director. And they were, you know, partners in more ways than one. No wonder I like them so much. McGovern Mullen just doesn't have the same ring.
Babe, that's because one of them is a merchant.
Yeah,
okay?
The other is Ivory. It's
okay?
Great.
It's like,
great.
McGovern Mullen. It could be a political ticket, to be quite honest with you.
It'd do really well with the Irish vote. Anyway, Merchant Ivory, are they the right people to handle this material in any way?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen it yet.
No, well, come on, John.
In 1989, aren't they a sign of quality?
It's like saying, oh, we can take literary material, but it's more classics. This is something new and up to the minute. Now, the interesting thing, and I think perhaps the crucial thing for the likely failure of this movie, 3 words. Merchant Ivory is 2 words. There's another person involved in their little love triangle.
What, 3 words?
The woman has 3 words in her name.
What? Bernadette Peters.
No.
What?
Ruth Prar Jabala.
Oh, excuse me.
Ruth Prar Jabala is...
Try saying that fast.
I know, you can't. She is the habitual screenwriter for Merchant Ivory. She did not write the screenplay when they adapted Slaves
of New York. She probably flat out refused.
Do you know who did?
Tama.
Tama adapted the screenplay herself and stars in the film. So Tama plays Bernadette Peters' best friend, I believe. As much as it's a Merchant Ivory production, it is also a Tama Janowitz joint.
Yeah.
In some ways, I actually suspect that a Nora Ephron, you know, someone who is actually a sharp crafter of actual romantic comedies and urban things, could take this material and probably make something that really had a backbone to it. But I don't have high hopes that Tama, on her first time, is going to be able to do it.
Also, isn't this the same year that When Harry Met Sally came out? You know that, like, When Harry Met Sally is clearly an 80s film, but it does not feel old.
It's timeless.
Yeah.
Like,
apart from the size of the phones and the size of the hairdos.
Yeah, and talking about, like, late 80s references, we've watched the trailer of this many times, so much that Sean has a way that he loves to say the name of this movie.
Yeah, I've already said it a lot of times, so even though it's not in the trailer, it's just more like Max Headroom, slaves of New York.
But it literally has all those, like, pew, pew, pew sound effects and, like, graffiti art style graphics.
Slaves of New York.
Yeah, and what are are some of the like music cues that we're
Well, there's that song, Good Life, Good Life, Good Life. I love that song.
Well, I came across this YouTube video that had like 80s scene personalities like Michael Musto and DJ Larry T.
Oh, Larry T. Local London lad, Larry
well,
T.
Well, they're literally hanging out in the meatpacking district being extras on the set of Slaves of New York. And they're like, yeah, we're doing this for Tama. Tama wants us to be here. And they've been making us wait while Bernadette Peters gets her makeup done. And I was like, what the fuck is this?
I gotta watch this.
Because we've already done the meatpacking district in the 70s via cruising, which had the whiff of poppers. So I'm not quite sure.
Just like this room being odorized as we speak.
So what's this whiff going to be? Cocaine, I suppose, is the whiff
if
of
we
choice.
Have to.
No, I mean in Slaves of New York.
Oh, excuse me. We should take cocaine during the interval and then come back for the second half.
It might help us get through the movie in the way that it helped Donald Trump get through that first debate with Hillary. Lastly, okay, so if there's anyone who's going to save us in this film, it is probably Tony Award-winning diva legend Bernadette Peters. Sean, I have a feeling that your appreciation of Bernadette Peters is a relatively new phenomenon, perhaps coterminous with having met me?
Yes.
So, what did you know Bernadette Peters from? Anything? Have you seen Annie?
I only watched the orphanage scenes of Annie. I try and rack my brain. Was she in anything else that I'd know?
Well, she always pops up in things. I mean, she's been in a couple Mel Brooks things. Have you ever seen Pennies from Heaven with Steve Martin?
I almost did once. Yeah.
On stage, obviously, she's huge, right? But similar to like someone like Nathan Lane, she's been in a bunch of movies, but her like stratospheric status is so different on stage to the way it is in film.
Well, she obviously had nothing like Mouse Hunt in her filmography, which introduced a small child named Sean McGowan to the brilliance of Nathan Lane.
Bernadette, I think she must have met up with Isabella Rossellini and got that youth serum they're selling in Death Becomes Her, because the woman is quite old. She must be, but
she's quite old for how she looks.
She looks amazing.
Yeah.
How does she do it, Sean?
Well, Brian, two words, the Peters principle. Now, we once read this article in which she said that she eats sashimi every single day. And, like, she has a potato as a treat. I mean, come on.
So, obviously, it's not the way we live our lives. Yeah. But on certain nights of the week when we know we're going to be out late and might be a bit, you know, worse for wear, we try to dine on sashimi.
Yeah, if Brian doesn't want a full stomach, shall we say, he has sashimi. But he wants that hit of protein. You know what I'm talking about.
So Bernadette Peters has influenced our lives in that way. I mean, some people, maybe if they're disparaging Bernadette Peters, they talk about her as a Cupid doll. Like, she's this kind of childlike little voice, you know, and she kind of looks...
Childlike little voice.
Yeah, but you had another reference point for how she looks.
Oh, she looks a bit like Weird Al Yankovic, doesn't she?
It may be that he looks more like her. I don't mean...
You told me once that I sing a bit like Bernadette Peters.
Well, it's that kind of... roundedness and the breathiness of the way that you sing. Yeah, you know, I love Bernadette Peters. I mean, I think Dot and Sunday in the Park, like, I mean, how many times...
Sunday in the Park with George.
How many times...
That's how I sing.
How many times do I say things to you like, you're not good, you're not right, you're just nice, I'm the witch.
I mean, far too often is the answer.
Do you think...
I actually despise you.
So she's basically Meg Ryan in this movie, and Tama Jenowitz herself is Carrie Fisher.
Ugh.
It's like fondue. It's like too much cheese. Like, you need something to offset something, but they're both too spacey in a way.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really going in with an open mind.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it must be said, we are watching Slaves of New York so that you don't
never have to.
All right, is it time for some good life, good life?
It is.
Where's that sashimi? Sorry. Sean, can you mix wasabi with cocaine?
I'm about to.
All right, get that
Say that again.
Get out the sashimi because...
It's dinner time.
All right.
Let me take you to a place I know you wanna go. It's a good life.
Don't come in. Eleanor, look at my leg. Do you see these red dots?
I see a tiny red dot.
Why are you being so difficult? This is not a tiny red dot. These are 6 red dots. These are flea bites. The house is invested with fleas. I came home this afternoon and I found a flea on my arm. I told you not to take the dog to the pier. If you're gonna take the dog out, I told you, don't bring him to where there's garbage and rats and fleas.
Sash, I
don't. Eleanor, don't try and argue with me. You're a lousy liar. Now I'm gonna bring you the laundry bag. And don't come in until you've taken your clothes off. They're invested.
What? You want me to take my clothes off in the hall? What about the Lewinsky comes home?
I think, no, you're speaking too close to the microphone. You come in and you come out. How are we going to solve this problem?
Have you ever seen The Princess Diaries?
No.
Okay, well, could you get, like, first of all, put me in a high-backed chair, and then,
stop.
Okay, put me in a high-backed chair, tie an Hermes scarf across my chest so I can't...
And I just yank you back?
No, it won't yank me back, it'll just prevent me from...
Am I Julie Andrews in this scenario?
Are you recording this?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, hello. I think we have somehow absorbed the Tama Janowitz spirit just to display there, which is aimlessness.
Yeah.
Banter... that goes nowhere, and lots of pop cultural references.
And also setup. Lots of setup, but no payback. There's going to be no...
Payoff. I have to say, we spent our last episode railing against The Color Purple, which was a book we loved and a film we despised. While I don't think Slaves of New York is a good movie, I kind of enjoyed watching it.
It's mildly enjoyable. Mildly. Everything about it is mild, actually.
Can we say, I don't think that's totally true. First of all, we gasped as the opening credits rolled. I mean, we didn't prepare our listeners for this at all, because we didn't know.
Yeah.
It's full of actors we know and love.
Yeah, Steve Buscemi is in it.
Steve Buscemi, Academy Award winner Mercedes Rule.
Yeah.
The great Mary Beth Hart.
Yeah, Stanley Tucci.
Yes, an uncredited Stanley Tucci.
You know, he is credited,
he's not above the title or in the opening credit roll. Yeah, very young. And very buff Stanley Tucci.
Yeah, he has those sinewy 80s arms I love.
Yeah. Part of the fun was waiting for all these familiar character actors. Like, who were they going to be in pop-up? Chris Sarandon is mentioned in the opening credits. And at the end of the movie, both of us were like...
Which one was he?
So, as the movie started to roll, there was the graffiti of the Meatpacking District and the Lower East Side and all of that. And Bernadette was walking that Dalmatian down the street with her frizzy hair and the 80s music playing. I was thinking, maybe this movie's going to be more fun than I thought.
Maybe it'll be more like Mannequin.
I have to say, the filmmaking of this movie is exemplary in a certain way.
Like, in a very certain way.
Well, no, but what I mean is visual. And actually, it's really hard for us to describe the pleasures of this movie verbally. And I've encouraged you to take quite a lot of screenshots of the film. So as a visual companion, it's like Lemonade. It's both... This episode is our version of Lemonade. What I mean is, as a visual companion to this discussion, people should go on to @BroadAppealPod Twitter and scroll through the look of the shots that you picked, or maybe we should put them on our website on a little blog entry, because I actually think looking at some of the shots and some of the costumes and some of the decor and the designs gives you just a whiff of what's really fun about Slaves of New York. The crazy hats they wear, and Bernadette Peters' amazing kind of mane of curly hair that bops around.
What about the dry ass hair, knotted ratty mess that is Tama Janowitz's hair?
We knew to expect that.
It's inexcusable how bad her hair is.
Okay, twice in the film, Tama Janowitz herself appears as a character called Abby.
Tama Janowitz, who really hasn't mastered the art of intonation ever.
I guess James Ivory somehow thought it would be clever and fun to put her into her own movie, once toward the beginning of the movie and once toward the end. But did you notice they've carefully selected the two bits that she'll be in? So she has to interact with no one except Bernadette.
Yeah.
Like, describe the first scene and the last scene that
she's in. Well, the first scene, she's in a hairdresser's getting her fucking horrid hair treated.
They must be putting, like, little boll weevils inside something, Like, tumbleweed.
Yes.
Anyway, carry on.
It's actually that scene that I read in the first half about, you know, the way that, you know, you either are a slave owner or a slave. Even though there's like two hairdressers there, she doesn't really interact with them. There was a very kind of unprepared a feeling about Tama Janowitz in this.
All she's being asked to do is essentially read extended prose sections of her own book as if she's part of the movie, but it has nothing to do with anything else. I mean, you just did that in the first half of the podcast, and you did it...
Yeah, I did with far more energy than she did.
She did. The second half comes in the climactic, quote-unquote, dinner party scene that Bernadette throws at her house.
Nothing about this film is climactic.
Tama Janowitz's character is the only other woman in attendance at this dinner party, and she locks herself in the bathroom. So Bernadette comes in, and she delivers, like, another couple of brief paragraphs, and then she leaves. Maybe she's agoraphobic or something like that.
Maybe they're like, she can't interact with humans, so let's just keep a fixed camera on her.
You know, it must have been interesting having the writer on the set. I have a feeling Ruth Prior Jhabvala did some sort of uncredited, you know, tweaking of this somehow.
Well, because it just feels more human than the book. My issue with the book in particular is that even when you know the people are talking to each other, whenever I read it, I think, this person's talking and the next person is not listening. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that is what the book feels like. It feels like people who are sitting there with their own thoughts, but are waiting until the other person has to come to an end of their own little monologue.
And you know, I have to say that that is perfectly captured in my notes that I took, because as people know, I take notes. And it's mostly to help me remember, like, oh, that wonderful moment. But I wrote down these lines, and I honestly can't tell you for the life of me where in the story they come. So, lines like, I'm the type of person who mates for life, like a goose. Porcupines will follow a trail of Tums anywhere. You know, it's desperate for the calcium.
Like, I do not remember, like, that at all.
I remember it being said, but I, like, have literally no idea, like, what context it is. They're just sort of wandering aimlessly around these party scenes.
You know, this film is full of people who would readily describe themselves as quirky. Okay? That is a warning in life. If anybody ever describes themselves as quirky, you have to stop talking and run away.
You are being very aggressive. You sound like you really didn't like this movie, whereas I actually think we had some fun watching it. There was an early revelation that a lot of fun. So as soon as Bernadette comes home with her walking the Dalmatian through the opening credit sequence, she opens the door of her gorgeous loft apartment, and who, something even more gorgeous is there?
Okay, so I didn't know who Adam Coleman Howard was. I still don't
Does
really.
Does anyone know who old Adam Coleman Howard
but
is?
But he is gorgeous. He has a gorgeous body. It's just lean enough. It's just toned enough. The perfect amount of skinny. It is just right.
Describe what he looks like when she opens that door with her shopping bag.
Okay, so he's this kind of bouffant, curly-haired, boyish, beard scruffy, furrowing brow, not quite bad boy, but like dickish type.
He's essentially a privileged art boy who seems hip and cool, but is actually quite uptight and infantile. Essentially a description of most of the people you get a crush on who aren't me.
Yes. Thank you, Brian. You also forgot deeply troubled.
And in the opening scene, there he is in his little... Isn't he wearing like Mickey Mouse boxers?
He's wearing very cute red Mickey Mouse boxer shorts. And we get a lovely bit where Bernadette Peters gets to go down and on her hands and knees to inspect the flea bite. Immediately, this film is set up with, there are fleas in the house. Do they ever get mentioned ever again?
Maybe we should just make a list of all the things. Like, literally, if you were a screenwriter and you're like, okay, I've got this relatively unconnected set of stories, but, you know, I could, like, loosely link them by certain things that might run through. So, flea infestation. Okay. Classic New York thing, right? Bug infestation.
Okay, she makes hats. The fleas. She could have had a very important fashion show, and the fleas get into the hats. Okay, it's just an idea.
Nowhere. Never mentioned. Similar fashion later on. She meets Steve Buscemi.
Wilfredo.
He was great.
He
looked sort of young and...
He looks like someone I know awful lot.
It's the most attractive I've ever found Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, me too. Okay, one scene that I did actually love, when she comes to the studio to pick up a coat that she's promised, the girl on the front desk is like, I don't know anything about this, and I can't help you. And I thought that was the closest thing to real life in the whole film.
Surly art gallery receptionist.
Yeah.
So she's come to pick up a coat, and Steve Buscemi, like, repeatedly makes a reference to this, like, kind of neon green chinchilla fur thing.
Yeah, with a train.
It has, like, a tail. It has,
like, I first of all thought it was disgusting.
Yeah, it looks disgusting. I mean, I think it's meant to, but he keeps saying, it's a great coat. Just don't put it near heat because it'll catch on fire. And yeah. So you're like, oh, great.
And then the next scene is a nightclub scene. And there are scenes of people just lighting cigarettes. And you're like, oh, my God, it's going to burn, it's going to happen. Nothing. Zero.
There's all sorts of things that could possibly happen. They contrive to get the other annoying character, Marley Martello, the artist, to, like, run into Bernadette Peters a couple of times. And he sort of wants her to model for him, but he doesn't. Okay. So I actually think that this version of the movie is very accurate to Tamma Janowitz's aimless style. It doesn't really work as a coherent piece. Yeah, it's infantile. It's full of banter that goes nowhere.
It's sexless.
Yeah, so that even though Adam Coleman Howard is, like, nice to look at, and Bernadette Peters looks lovely. I mean, actually, the whole thing is populated by very pretty people. You know what it has slightly? It's a bit of that Ryan Murphy syndrome. James, you know, Ivory. I mean, I don't want to stereotype him for being a gay director. But, like, every single man in every single role in this movie is quite cute in some way or other. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, like, in Feud, even, like, the, like, bus attendant will look like he's, like, out of a West Hollywood, you know, kind of casting couch situation with Ryan Murphy.
Yeah, he's like a Sean Cody model.
Yeah, exactly. And this,
I prefer a bit more Helix Studios myself.
But I think the same is true of the kind of people that they've populated every single character in here. They're kind of like a cute art twink in some way, or else like a slightly intellectually muscly beefcake, like literally every man in this movie, it seems like. So that gives it a certain pleasure, but there's no sex. You're absolutely right.
There is a sex scene between Adam Coleman Howard's stash and
the evil, bitchy art rival.
Yeah, the postcoital, it's overlooking Times Square. You don't believe for a second that these people have had, like, a bit of hardcore How's Your Father.
If we were really in this party scene in the 80s and the art world, I'm sure they would be on drugs, they would be fucking, they would be cursing, there would be just a lot more hard-edged conflict, and there's none. It literally feels like kindergarten characters playing at art world
stuff.
Well,
you know what else they wouldn't be doing, Brian?
What else?
You wouldn't be finding all the leading and peripheral characters coming together to play a softball game. Why introduce characters in this one scene? Stanley Tucci and Mercedes Rule, everybody's in it. You know, it is pointless.
That's another thing that never goes anywhere. Stanley Tucci and Mercedes Rule are introduced as a couple. Mercedes Rule, she's both pregnant and recovering from drug rehab.
And she's a rival hat maker.
None of these things figure at any point ever in the rest of the story. It makes you wonder, did they film other scenes and just not put them in the movie? In past episodes, you have often told us, like, what your version of directing the movie would be if you were to do it, right?
Usually histrionic, operatic,
Baroque and Rococo.
Yeah.
Now, I actually think that James Ivory, so he has actually captured the true Tamma Janowitz, which is a series of random, unrelated, unrealistic, semi-satiric episodes. Now, I found out something interesting. To the extent that Wikipedia can be believed, apparently this script was originally written for Andy Warhol to film. Have you ever seen any of the Warhol-directed or produced movies from those kind of factory stable of actors where they're all kind of aimlessly walking around and talking and not really doing anything and looking pretty and weird and drugged out?
I've only seen them on mute, projected on walls of nightclubs.
How Tamma Janowitz of you. I could imagine a version of Slaves of New York that was, like, way more toward the, like, flat blandness of, like, the Warhol superstars. But then you would not want, like, Bernadette Peters being a perky Broadway performer. You would want, like, I don't know, fucking Candy Darling and everybody around. And, like, then Tamma's own performance would seem to fit right in with kind of everybody being spacey, right?
Yeah, that is true.
The other version I can imagine would be the Nora Ephron version that I talked about,
yeah,
which they give, like, a hint of, because basically, for all of the movie, Sexy Stash, who you loved so much, treats Bernadette Peters' Eleanor like shit, right? She's essentially a doormat. He just tells her she's insecure, he cheats on her, she has no talent, he ignores her.
Where were you? Why didn't you call me? What happened?
Dario was helping me at the studio, and I walked her home and took her dog for a walk, and it was attacked by a cheetah.
We have a dog here. Tell me you're having an affair. That's why you've been acting so weird, to cover up.
There's nothing between Dario and me, Eleanor. We've been friends for years and years. We used to hang out all the time.
I paid for half of that Godzilla lighter for her birthday. She never even thanked me.
She's like fainting and dizzy in a nightclub. He's like, get up, come on. You know, you're kind of just waiting for the I am woman, hear me roar moment where she's going to stand up to him, which comes, right? They give us that.
It's the only bit and of like the, anything that resembles drama.
Yeah, it's the only turnaround point. And then she's like, for the last scene and a half, she's a single and successful woman. That's a kind of Nora Ephron type thing. Like, just look at Heartburn. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
I loved it.
Just kind of like neurotic career woman in a bad relationship who like comes to the realization that she's her own person. And there'd be like a best friend character played by Rosie O'Donnell or Carrie Fisher or what's that woman who's married to Tom Hanks?
Oh, Mimi Rogers.
No, she was married to Tom Cruise.
Oh, shit,
you know that woman.
Oh, what's her
name? You know her name.
Come on. She's like Mimi Rogers.
No, she's nothing like Mimi
Rita
Rogers.
Wilson. Rita. I have to really underemphasize these T's a little bit.
Mimi Rogers is Barbra Streisand's sister in The Mirror Has Two Faces.
But isn't that like Rita like Wilson in Everyday Life? No?
No. What I'm saying is that
Rita!
The Nora Ephron, we have not smoked any weed. This is purely the effect of Slaves of New York.
I wish I did, that's for sure.
So the Nora Ephron version, could you see it? It would be much tighter plotting.
You would have to have surgery on that film.
Yeah, but they
like you, open heart surgery.
You could take the episodes like the softball game and the party where her blender won't stop going, or when she gets trapped in the bathroom. And they'd actually be constructed for like farcial shape, you know, because Nora Ephron is nothing if not a tight centerist.
Farcial? What do you mean farcical?
No, I mean farcial.
Farcial. Because farcial law. That's what you want.
Okay, but the last director who I think could have done some great work with this is Robert Altman, okay?
Ah.
So characters come in and out, there's overlapping dialogue, there's improvisation. I mean, part of the problem with this is that even though the staging and everything is like emphasizing they're all wandering around parties, they're all talking with this overbaked dialogue that was already written in a short story like 6 years earlier. Do you know what I mean? Whereas like Altman's sense of getting his actors to loosen up and be really natural and kind of improvise and come in and out of the shot, because he made a great version of all Raymond Carver's short stories when he did Shortcuts, you know, and he had this amazing way of moving his camera and just zeroing in on different things that almost seem in the periphery of the frame. I mean, I know he did Prêt-à-Porter, which is dreadful, and is kind of like the Tamara Janowitz.
I would watch that. Bjork is in that, you know.
So is Sophia Loren. So it's a shame. I'm not saying that James Ivory hasn't done a bad job, but I think he's been almost too faithful to his original source material.
Also, don't you think that maybe this is just not his forte? Like, James Ivory is probably happiest when he's tightening someone into a bodice.
They
putting a ringed skirt on someone.
They didn't really wear bodices and ring skirts in Edwardian times.
I'm thinking more of the South.
Yeah, well, he didn't direct Jezebel.
I'm thinking more of Baton Rouge.
I don't know what you're talking about. He didn't direct Anne Rice either. But now, you are being more negative now that we've turned the microphone on than you were, because you actually had quite a lot to say about the mise-en-scène.
So, I do believe that, like, visually...
Farcical.
That Dr. James Merchant Ivory has a distinct vision in capturing the moment. And though, so there are some scenes, I think I've tweeted some already, that are in many ways like inconsequential to anything. And just the framing, his positioning, the focus, the stillness, it's like, it does look like a a painting.
Well, he's
it does look like pop art.
But this is what I'm saying, because he's employing the same DP that he does for Howard's End and Room with a View. In a way, the way that those films mirror, I guess, like, I don't know, the Pre-Raphaelites. I wouldn't be surprised if they did study pop art or, you know, 80s kind of Jeff Koons kind of art, and just said, well, if these people are artists and this is the kind of cartoonish world that they create, because actually stashes cartoons. He like takes Polaroids
of the
Popeye
TV,
cartoons on the TV, and then he blows them up into these big canvases. So in a way, the visual look to me of the movie is great. And you have to admit that Bernadette's fashion sense, I think you would wear those outfits even sooner than you would wear baggy Handmaid's ones from the Handmaid's.
Everybody gets good clothes in this. Mary Beth Hurt gets to wear this beautiful day glow smock dress with a little kind of a turtlenecky part of it. So I was all over that immediately. Bernadette at the baseball scene wears these lovely simple black leggings with what appears to be like a cardigan with no sleeves. over like a tank top, and I love
that. What about when she's working as a copy editor at the newspaper?
Oh, like big padded heavy shoulders with a nice brooch. Also what I loved, and it was on a few of the women, it was orange eyeshadow.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, your blue eyeshadow has been done to death. That was such a... Do you remember that in the 80s? Blue eyeshadow.
You weren't even born.
No, but my mother... My mother
sat me down on her knee and said...
My mama told me when I was young... Okay.
Put some blue on upon your eyes.
No, but my mother didn't buy makeup for quite a while, so some of the color palettes that she had, even in like the late 90s, were still the ones she bought in the early 80s.
This is Lanesborough County, Longford. It's the trickle-down makeup.
Sorry,
effect.
My mother's a feminist. She didn't feel the need.
Carry out.
Orange eyeshadow. Just some great headgear and stuff.
Oh, fabulous. They look sort of like, often they're wearing like ashtrays on their head or sort of...
Can I be honest with you? I hated the hats. I thought the hats looked cheap and shitty. I couldn't suspend my disbelief, okay? Those hats were shite, okay?
Do you remember the...
Fucking shite.
Do you remember the fashion show? They're wearing like...
Sorry to swear.
Day glow, plastic, patchwork, raincoat.
Also hated it.
That was a real fashion designer.
I know.
I, as a former intern at PS122 in the East Village... I was trying to guess, like, when they go to the nightclubs and there's various burlesque performance art scenes, are these real performance artists or are they parodies? There's one woman wrapped in bubble wrap inside a bathtub who's, like, soaping herself up with bits of celery stalks and things, and I could only think it was, like, some sort of weird Karen Finley parody. She's the woman who Jesse Helms hated because she covered herself in chocolate on an NEA grant.
Oh, go fuck yourself, Jesse Helms.
I know, we hate Jesse Helms. They go to another nightclub at one time, and the singer is black. I thought instantaneously of La La Land. This is a movie
There are four black people in this film.
There are four black people in this film. One of them is on stage performing, and the other three are these black drag queens in these amazing red ball gowns who just randomly, in a quite beautifully composed shot,
I have to agree.
Are dancing to like Motown with a big boombox on the street, and Bernadette's just watching it.
Yeah,
and
I said St. Mark's Church.
Yeah, and then she just goes back to whatever conversation she's having.
Heard some dreary, drab, boring conversation. Those four black characters are having a much better time than all the white people in this film. You know what I mean?
Again,
they're off living their lives.
I guess what I'm saying is like, okay, I would put on Slaves of New York at a party... with the sound off
projected on the wall
and everybody be like, oh, look at that show. Oh, that's a great outfit. Like, that's the kind of movie it ultimately is. It really pops visually. It's interesting to look at. Bad movies often get nominations for craft categories. Suicide Squad won a fucking Oscar for makeup. The costume design and the aesthetic of this film really are worth a look.
I mean, they're worth a look, but when that's the thing you have got going for you more than anything else in a film.
There's one other thing that it has going for it. The largest petroleum company in Great Britain, BP.
Oh, yes. The Peters Principle. Just two things. The Peters Principle and the Mercedes Rule.
Mercedes rules. Bernadette is in quite a lot of this movie, and she is a soldier. She is really trying to make you care about Eleanor, and she's trying to play neurotic and anxious. I think she has a line towards the end where she says, happiness to me is the same feeling as anxiety, ugh, or something like that.
Well, actually, I can totally understand that feeling, but at the same time, I say, ugh. Bernadette Peters, you know, every time she pops up anywhere, you are reminded how delightful this person is. Don't you think that, like, theater actors are real workers? They're real worker bees. honeybees, worker bees, compared to strictly screenwriters?
Well, yeah, I mean, they have the dedication because they have to, like, hit their marks 8 times a week. You know, you have some performers, like Nathan Lane in his worst film roles, who... No, but they're really trying too hard because they're used to, like, selling it to the back row. Mm. And what's interesting about Bernadette Peters in this, she underplays it quite a lot. This is not Patti LuPone in Tammy Janowitz, right?
I wish...
Patti LuPone would have eaten Bernadette's character for lunch.
Yeah.
But, like, Bernadette Peters is very winning. It kind of made me sad that there aren't more leading film roles for Bernadette. I don't know, some rom-coms or some sort of proto-Jennifer Aniston types or Meg Ryan type characters.
I see her more as the kind of the busty old flirt. You know what I mean? Bernadette Peters is of the age now where she could be the saucy president of... an NGO.
We have to watch Mozart in the Jungle because she's the chairman of the board of the New York Philharmonic.
Oh, is she?
Yeah.
Oh, then I've just cast her in exactly what she needs to be in.
Yeah, the Golden Globe award-winning original series.
Is that still on?
I don't know if it's still on. Gael Garcia Bernal, Bernadette Peters, and Malcolm McDowell, so it couldn't be all bad.
Don't forget the inimitable, the incomparable... The legendary, yeah, that's it, Saffron Burroughs, is that right? The reason I know this is because, you know on, like, the Golden Globe carpet when it's, like, all the cast of things turn up? I was like, who the fuck is that woman? I don't know if you've seen Saffron Burroughs. She has this very jagged face. She'd contoured, like, every angle.
What would Michelle Visage say about that?
She'd be like, your moustache is showing.
You know, all the best actresses have spices for names, if you ask me.
Such as?
Saffron.
Pepper. Anything else?
Ginger. Surely there must be ginger.
Ginger Rogers.
There you go.
Ginger spice. All right, what about ginseng? That's more of a root.
That was a long riff that you were basically saying Bernadette Peters should play a busty barmaid.
No. She needs to play a very busty yet high-powered woman.
A sort of powerful... So you want to see her in Damages?
No. It has to be like an NGO.
You want to see her in the television adaptation of The Constant Gardener in the Rachel Weisz role?
I've never seen it. But what about this? She plays a very, very, very rich...
Woman who supports Médecins Sans Frontières.
Yeah, like...
And it's set in, like, the Ebola outbreak.
No. It's set in her Upper West Side apartment.
While she calls people in Liberia.
Yeah. Like,
does she get to sing?
Well, we'll see.
She sings at a charity fundraiser.
That's true.
We love you, Bernadette. Is that the sole plot? Does the entire NGO series take place in her Upper West Side apartment while she's eating sashimi?
No, it cuts to Liberia.
And is with, like, Idris Elba.
Oh, yes, Idris Elba. Also, Aziz Ansari is there. Barkhabt Abdi.
Shore Agudashilu.
Oh, yes. She's leading the whole thing. And the real drama is Bernadette on the phone with her credit card making donations.
I could see it as Alejandro G. Iñárritu, like, sequel to Babel.
Yeah, I could see it too.
I think everyone would fork over the dough to make this movie.
Also, it'll star Sofia Vergara in a rare dramatic role.
It's her version of Cake. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have got off the deep end.
Are we finished?
Aren't we?
Okay, no? So okay, let's do some closing points. Okay, did I like it? Sort of. Do I ever want to see it again? No.
The music.
Okay, there is a little known Boy George song, and it was off a weird album that was actually an amalgamation of two albums. It's called Girlfriend, but it might also be called Boyfriend.
How gender fluid.
I know, it was the 80s after all. And it plays over the end credits, and maybe it'll play over our end credits, I don't know.
Do you remember how the story, such as it is, ends? Bernadette, having become a successful hat maker,
gets herself an equally cardboard cutout boyfriend.
Well, yeah, but she basically throws...
Who's nice.
She throws a party. No, do you remember what his profession is?
No, I don't.
So she meets him in Tompkins Square Park. He's sort of hunky in a leather jacket. He helps her carry her shopping bags. He says, oh, my job is I sell the semen of racehorses.
Oh, yeah.
Yet another Janowitz zinger. Mm-hmm. And then she has a disastrous dinner party where no women come, only men. Her blender won't stop working.
But does her blender explode at any point? Does it get on any hats? Okay. No. No, it does not. And so after all this party is said and done, she kind of exchanges a glance with him and they go for a motorcycle ride across a bridge.
Probably the Manhattan Bridge, okay, or the Brooklyn Bridge.
And you know why it's anticlimactic, Brian? Because the last shot in the film is two stunt doubles with motorcycle helmets on.
You don't think that was really Bernadette Peters under that motorcycle helmet?
In the words of Sandra Bernhard, oh, I don't know, Dave. I really don't.
I'm glad that Sandra gets the last word on Tama's episode.
Do you think that maybe, like, Sandra was asked to be in this picture?
To be honest, Sandra should have played Daria.
She should have, yeah.
She would have been amazing.
She should have. She would be great.
She probably was still riding high on the King of Comedy at that point and was like, Merchant Ivory, come on, Sue Mengi.
Come on, Sue, give me a better deal. Actually, she would have been doing Without Show of Nothing at this point on stage.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that is Slaves of New York. So we've covered the 80s. What are we going to be doing next, Sean?
Well, we will be sparking up a doobie and going straight back to the 1970s to the very dope-tempered Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which Brian Mullen has described as reprehensible. You heard it here first.
If anyone doesn't know, Looking for Mr. Goodbar is the tell-all story of a sexually adventurous woman in the singles bar scene of the 1970s, played by Diane Keaton, an actress we have never covered on Broad Appeal. In the very same year that she won the Oscar for Annie Hall, I think she did one of those rare Golden Globes where you're nominated for one, the comedy, and the other, drama, and the drama was for Looking for Mr. Goodbar. It also features a young and hunky Richard Gere, among other things.
And an Oscar-nominated performance by Tuesday Weld.
I have a feeling that Looking for Mr. Goodbar is going to make us scared to have sex ever again.
Oh, dear.
So,
well, it has been 3.5 years. It feels right.
It's a good thing that our holiday to Greece is scheduled before we record the episode. Yeah.
I gotta say, it's an interesting book. We'll have lots to say on this.
Yeah.
I am really looking forward to the film. Isn't Richard Gere in it?
I just said that.
Okay. You can keep that in, though.
Where is this doobie? I think it's time. All right. You can tell we need a holiday. Ladies and gentlemen, when the next episode comes to your ears, we will be lying on a beach in the Isle of Greece
while we sip champagne near a yacht.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we are Brian and
Sean.
And you can find us at Broad Appeal Pod, where you can also find pictures of Stash's little twink art muscles. Go there, follow us, and go to our website, which is broadappealpod.com.
And follow us on Twitter at BA Mullen Speaks and at Sean McGovern X.
Subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher.
Anywhere you get your podcast. Anywhere. We don't care.
I don't actually think we're anywhere other than iTunes and Stitcher.
Okay, just there then. We will be sending you sweet, sweet love from Greece while we oil ourselves up and I turn a delightful shade of rouge.
Red, red one.
Yes, red one. When I come back from Greece, I'm going to be a red one.
And I'm going to be named Joanne. Okay, that's all we have to say. It's time to end this. Kalimera, Kalispera.
Kalispera.